And now we're speaking with Jonathan Bullock, and we're speaking about his new film, David Noble, A Wrench in the Gears. So, Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, I know you're actually putting together the final touches on this thing. You're engaged in this right now, and we want to get this out there, let people know what's going on. I mean, David Noble was a substantial figure. Why do you think it's important to make a documentary about him right now?
Well, the reason I did it was because I felt that even people who were part of the left and knew a lot about left-wing politics in Canada and North America, they didn't really know who he was. And I was always surprised. I would mention and throw his name out there, and only some people would know, but a lot of people wouldn't. And I'd be like, wow, I mean, for someone who's done so much, it's surprising that no one really knows who he is. So when he died, I was kind of shocked. I remember my jaw dropping when I read it online, and I was just felt like, oh no, like, you know, if this guy's work is just forgotten, I felt I had to do something about that and make sure that didn't happen. And my producer agreed as well when I showed her more of what he did. And so we felt, well, we got a camera, let's do something about this. And so we committed ourselves right there pretty much to do it.
Absolutely.
And, it's gone really, really well, actually.
Yeah, he was a prominent but somewhat distant figure. I mean, a lot of people heard about his work through email or through the newspapers, but hadn't really met him. I had finally gotten a hold of him and talked about some issues, but he passed away only a few months afterwards. It's good that you're making this because he was involved in so many issues, and we definitely should remember and be inspired by his work. Is it just you and your producer who are working on this?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it takes cooperation from everybody to make it actually happen. You know, a lot of his wife provided a lot of video material, and his brothers and his family provided a lot of images and things like this. And I used a little bit of stuff that was online too that other people had done to document what he did. So, you know, I couldn't do it all by myself, but the project's had a lot of good karma, I guess, a lot of cooperation. So,
well, there was a lot of people he helped, and this is a good way to remember him. I remember I was flooded with emails, and quite a number of organizations that I was familiar with lamented his passing. I know Independent Jewish Voices, Canadian Arab Federation, the Canada-Palestine Association, and I'm sure a number of other releases and notices landed in my email inbox. Those were just some of the issues that he worked in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did 35-plus years of activism, so there's quite a lot to cover.
Yes, it was a lifetime affair, and it goes back a long way. I think the earliest mention I recall was when he fought his university. I think it was the University of Rochester. He was completing his graduate degree, I think his PhD, and he was fighting them for control over his thesis. Because the way it worked there is that the university gets to sell your thesis or use it in certain ways, and he felt that was unfair given that he was writing it and paying to write it and so on. So it goes back a long way, and one of the first enterprises that he was involved in after graduating, I think, was the Smithsonian Institute. I'm not entirely sure what he did there. I had heard different stories about him either getting forced out when the Reagan administration came in or because he included a hammer from the Luddites. What exactly happened there?
Well, he did a display that was called Automation Boys and Their Toys. And if you know anything about his academic work, he was kind of critical of automation. Mm-hmm. And he basically saw it as another form of de-skilling. And, you know, there was the First Industrial Revolution where different machines would come in and there was assembly lines put in, division of labor. And then there was a kind of a second wave which came with automation in the 50s and 60s, which was, you know, linking computers up to production. And so he was very critical of this stuff, and, you know, he used that opportunity to express those views. And when they realized it, they fired him, pretty much. so that's that story.
Not the first time that would happen, or not the first time he would experience that. He did learn a great deal about automation, industrial processes, engineering, the history of industry, the history of science at his university, and certainly he was able to apply that knowledge. I guess the problem was he learned too much. A lot of this was coming in at the late 70s, early 80s, with the introduction of CNC machining and numerical control, or things that came after numerical control. It really prefigures the debate and the problems we're having today. Automation is putting a lot of people out of work. There's this big question of how many jobs will even exist in the future. David had been looking at these issues for decades. And one of the aspects of his research was that power control is built into systems. So it's not like technology is neutral. I think in two or three of his books, he looked at how engineers and scientists were being trained essentially to sort of slot into corporations to enhance, productivity and profit. And that came perhaps at the expense of other concerns. I mean, progress without people is one that we were assigned here at McMaster. He definitely has a number of widely regarded books on the subject.
Yes. There's a lot of things we could talk about there. I think he was always a little bit ahead of his time with the automation issue and also the virtual university. He was before people could really understand it. He was already writing books. He was investigating these things before they were really in anyone's consciousness. So I think that was another impressive thing about what he did.
Oh, I don't think anyone would argue with you there. I mean, you have people like Noam Chomsky commenting on that. He was one of the titanic intellects of our time in North America over the last few decades, and definitely was a very important scholar of industrial relations and history. As for the online aspect, you're right. He was ahead of his time. He was one of the first people to really take a serious look at what online education was, what it would develop into. I think he made some comparisons to the old mail correspondence courses of the turn of the 20th century. Around the year 1900, you could sort of like get a mail order degree that was introduced. And there's advantages and disadvantages to that. But he was really worried about how universities would use online education, because what it does is it takes control away from the professors and the educators involved in the process. There's a lot of tacit knowledge. There's a lot of things that professors do in terms of assigning materials, assigning readings, assigning papers, what students are supposed to do and when, and what are the best resources. The university wants to codify that, standardize it, make it so that they can bring in a less experienced person to teach the same thing, and the university can sort of change or control the materials. So he thought that education might suffer without the input of experienced educators, and he thought that the process itself, I think, would become degraded.
Yes, and as well, he had serious concerns about who actually owns the material. Once, I don't know if any of our listeners, I'm sure some of them have maybe done some online, but you're supposed to participate online using the programs that they have, and you write your comments, you submit your stuff, and it's gone, and you don't have ownership over that anymore, much like Facebook owns everything you have, you put up. And also there was questions of money and research and development of these technologies for online learning that were funded by universities, and there was conflicts of interest through different universities of people on boards and owning parts of these companies that are to develop the software, and then they're also working for the university at the same time, making the decisions to go ahead and work with these companies. So there was conflict of interest as well. It's in some cases a pretty big mess. And yeah, like you said, just the educational value of it, well, what is it? Like you said, they want to codify it. And David himself was very against, structuring a course and making you jump through every single hoop so you've, quote-unquote, completed it and passed and everything like that. So very much.
Yeah, I mean, he got in trouble when he refused to grade papers, remember, or grade students. He was going to give everyone an A. I think he managed to get York University to make one of his graduate courses a pass or fail course, which was almost unheard of.
Yeah, his view was, and the film focuses on this a lot, his view was that what motivates someone to learn is their own motivation that comes from within them. And anytime you're forcing someone to, they're not really committed. They're not that interested. So
yes,
he took away the threat of the grades and made it more like, well, whoever wants to learn can learn. If you want to write something, write something. I'll read it. If you don't, then don't. But he wouldn't punish the students by failing them. He would just give them all A's, and because he knew that, you know, students would go on to use those grades in the job market. So he would not want to harm anyone. What he would do is give them the A, and if they didn't show up, they didn't show up. But, you know, the people who did show up were good candidates to actually learn the best.
Right. I mean, he wanted to be there, part of the learning process, not follow some guidelines that were imposed. I think, you know, it's been said that everyone is born a scientist, and then you have to beat it out of them through an education system. But he wanted to encourage people's learning and explorational tendencies. All the advanced forms of learning in schools, Montessori and so on, have views that I believe are similar to David Noble's. And you brought up some very substantial points in terms of his views on education. He was concerned about corporate motives. You know, if corporations are involved in the educational process, what do they want and how does that differ from what we would call education? The ownership. Yeah, I think you're right. In this age of Facebook and Google, it's like a lot of us have just given up the concept of ownership. All the pictures, all your posts, they all belong to some server, which is, you know, increasingly disturbing given the revelations that have come out recently about the forms of internet monitoring. And we know what Noble would have thought about all of that, and he would have been very critical. I remember there was a Counterpunch article that he wrote or was interviewed for about peer review, the peer review process in terms of academic journal articles. Noble was familiar with the whole history of how this process unfolded with regard to taxpayer funding in World War II. It's an interesting story, but ultimately he was concerned about how banks are sitting on the boards of directors of these journals, and private companies can censor elements in an article before it's published. And ultimately, it sort of privileges certain forms of knowledge, this peer-reviewed knowledge. And that means that, for example, David Noble had no publications on a university CV. If they're not peer-reviewed, if they don't go through that process, if he has to list his works, you know, there could be nothing on there because he hasn't gone through that article process. It was only after he published his books that they were accepted by the academic community. So he had to go his own way, and I think he said it would not be possible for him to become a university professor in today's environment.
Mm-hmm. And including the workload. You know, he was, when he went to university, he was at that special time where students had a lot of power and they didn't have to be slaves the way they are today, where they just put their head down and if someone says do more work, then you do more work. You know, back then it was they could focus on other things and they weren't so bombarded, and they weren't penalized for this as much. So, yeah, he admits that, you know, in today's environment he probably couldn't get away with getting his degree.
No, you're right. It has to do partly with the social conditions. He came from a time when people often exhibited more backbone, I would think. But, you know, you're right. The education process today with the communication, he was upset about email use even because he thought it made it so that professors and staff had to be available at all times. I tried to contact David Noble. I couldn't reach him by email. I actually sent him some emails, but nothing happened. So I had to have a letter to him hand-delivered by university staff, and that's when he got back to me. And, you know, it's funny because now you have all these tablets and things, right? And office workers are being asked to bring their work home on tablets, and they're constantly available. They're constantly on call. So even when you leave the office, the work doesn't end. So he really did see the way things were going.
Mm-hmm. And another interesting thing with the email issue is, and I would suggest, he would push this, actually. When I first saw him speak at the University of Western Ontario, he would tell people and remind them that as a public citizen, you have the right to use the Freedom of Information Act to access the emails of anyone who works for the university, pretty much, in terms of their professional capabilities, like administrators. You know, there's privacy issues about, like, individuals, but anything that is said between deans and all these different people can be brought up for free. and he would often use this tool, like, a lot to investigate people at the university who he thought were not doing what they should be doing in whatever form that may be. And so he himself knew, too, as well, that, you know, using the email within the university system, it's open potentially to the public, and also the management of the university owns and can read those emails at any time.
Yes.
They can actually spy on their own staff.
Well, I guess, you know, it brings into question what a Luddite is, because he's been called a Luddite a number of times. And, you know, it's not about necessarily hating technology, the way I'm interpreting it, but rather understanding what it is and how it's being used. And I'm sure he had other uses in mind for technological developments, and he was capable of analyzing and evaluating these developments as they unfolded.
Yeah, and he also, in terms of technology, also wrote about the views that people who developed technology had, like religious views about technology, and how technology is often framed in terms of the idea of progress. That automatically, if there's a piece of technology introduced to a situation, it's bettering the situation. And you'd say, well, whoa, what do you mean? Why is it automatically a good thing? You know, let's look at the implications of this. And so, yeah, that Luddism stuff definitely came in, and you know, the thing is, it was often used as an insult to him, but, you know, he took it as kind of a compliment.
Well, yeah. I mean, when a piece of technology or a type of technology is introduced, there were values and assumptions behind that technology when it was introduced. People already had an idea in mind of what they wanted to do. I mean, yeah, you're right. He wrote at least one book on the subject of the religious aspects of science in Western culture. He looked at also the role of women in science, or how they were excluded at a certain point. I mean, he's got a lot of interesting books. I haven't read any of them in 5 years, but it's probably a good time to pick them up again. But that was just one of his interests, technology in general and the history of it, or the application. He was involved in all sorts of social justice issues. I know he was involved in the Palestine Solidarity Movement. Certainly much of the email exchanges and stories about Dr. Noble came through a variety of organizations that I'm involved with. Most recently, I suppose, at York University, he was involved in a number of interesting issues and disputes. One of the more public ones was probably the issue of holidays, Jewish holidays, because he was criticizing the fact that there were holidays on Jewish holidays when there were not for other religions. So it looks like he had an issue of fairness here.
Yeah, and that there were not many The Jewish people at York were a minority, and yet he was not allowed to teach on those days. Anybody, he couldn't have classes on those days. So he did challenge that, and they in the courts, and they ruled in his favor. And York stopped doing that.
Right.
So now they can teach on those days. You know.
That was just one thing. I mean, I guess it was around 2004, I think. A number of articles touch on that. He wrote a pamphlet in which he suggested there was this sort of institutional connection between pro-Israel lobbying and funding agencies at York University, which he thought probably was connected with the way certain pro-Palestine students or organizations were treated. I mean, that caused quite a hoopla.
Yeah. He definitely tried to take on the Israeli or the Zionist lobby in the institutions that he worked in, and yeah, that is usually controversial. It ends up being controversial one way or another. He was called an anti-Semite.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. David Noble is Jewish, or was Jewish, and a member of Independent Jewish Voices here in Canada, and that accusation of anti-Semitism, that came about in response to that pamphlet, and he actually sued against those accusations. And that's interesting, because he must have been one of the very first people to do that.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. He died during those proceedings, so the trial dissolved, and the charges dissolved based on that. But Yeah, that was a big move. He didn't like what was said.
Well, it was just being used as a cudgel here in Canada. I know around the same time, or maybe it was in 2010, I think, there was another professor out east, a Jewish professor, a member of Independent Jewish Voices, who was also called anti-Semitic for criticizing, I guess, this pro-Israel lobby operating on campuses. So it's a common cudgel. And I think what Noble was doing was he was trying to make it more costly to use this tactic. You know, if these pro-Israel lobby groups are going to go around calling everyone anti-Semitic, well, he made it so that they're going to have to pay a price. And he sued them. And he was doing quite well. He was making some interesting progress there. And you know, I think he was just tired of this very dishonest tactic.
Oh, yeah, it definitely is a bully tactic, for sure. It definitely is. Anytime you criticize Israel, you know, and they're likely to come out, some group, to call you an anti-Semite, and that's a form of trying to shut you down, trying to discredit you and what you're doing. So, yeah, I think, you know, he was trying to counter that.
And he was so intelligent and conscientious, it was very difficult to bully him. And, I mean, he had won so many prior engagements, and he waited, I don't know, 5-7 years for a settlement at a previous university after they mistakenly or wrongly fired him. And he fought that battle. He was fighting many at the same time, and he was fighting many organizations at the same time. I mean, it makes for a great film, a great documentary. I'm not sure how you're structuring this documentary, but I understand you do have contact with the family and academics and professors he was involved in. So is it a series of interviews, or how are you putting this together?
Mm-hmm, yes, I've used some of his lectures and some footage that's never been seen from that he had recorded, but he hadn't released it. So there's going to be new footage, and there's going to be interviews with people who knew him, his friends, people he worked with, like Denis Rancourt, his fairly big name, and a professor he knew here in London, Ontario, which was very convenient, Nick Dyer Witherford, and Janice Newson, who was also worked with him at York for many years. So, yeah, commentary on what he did, explaining more of what he did, and a lot of it is in his own words, due to the footage that I've been able to amass, and which is great. You know, like the thing is, he was a great speaker. He was a very charismatic person. A lot of what he said was things you didn't really hear very often. So a lot of times I let him do the work, and that's fine. It comes off really well.
Yeah, he really took on some sacred cows. Like on a variety of issues, it would be impossible even to cover all the ones that he did, including in the pages of Counterpunch or at universities or wherever. He was very widely respected among my peers. I guess, you know, there's a question of how this is going to be released. I know you have an online presence, number one. Where can people find your website?
Well, we have a website called revivalfilms.ca, and when we get some screenings booked, which should be shortly, we're going to post them on there. There's also a Facebook page. And eventually we're going to release it. You can also buy a copy of it. We'll send a copy to you. And we're also probably going to end up putting it on YouTube online for educational purposes.
Wow. Well, with all that's happening, as I said, the problem of automation or the role of automation today or having a pro-Israel government in Canada. I mean, there's so many issues that he would be continuing to comment on, and that's why some of the obituaries for him were so moving, in that they were lamenting not only the passing away of David Noble, but also the actions and activities he would have been part of were it not for his untimely passing. And we could certainly have used a talent like his today. We can try to learn as best we can from his struggle, the fact that he was not scared to take anything on. He would fight for his rights. He would use all the mechanisms, legal, electronic, technological, to meet these objectives. I think he set an example that many of us should be following. So I'm glad that you're making a documentary about this. I'm glad it's coming out soon. Certainly, we're going to be able to reach it. We might be able to discuss it further after it comes out. I do hope people go on to your website and check it out. What's the website called again?
Revivalfilms.ca.
Revivalfilms.ca. I understand there's a brief clip of the documentary or people that were involved in it. It's probable that you might have more promotional material soon as it comes out. So thanks very much for doing that. We can direct people to revivalfilms.ca. if that's the address.
Yep.
Good. Okay. And we'll try to announce screenings and showings. I'm sure there will be some here in South Ontario, so it won't be too hard to get out to that. Well, that's great. Well, John, thanks very much for giving us the time. I know it's coming up perhaps as early as this month, so it's a great time to talk about it. And thanks so much for being on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate your program. Keep up the great work. And I'm glad there's folks out there like you.
Thanks, John.